welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right, welcome back, and you are listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions, and we just left off with covering Article 6 of the Constitution, almost covering it. We still have to wrap up some stuff. And as you know, this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And any questions on the Constitution, because I may not have covered it in detail enough for you. It may be kind of important to you, and you may go, well, can you get back to me, or can you help explain this? By all means, that's why we have Feedback Friday going through all of this. I'm not begging for feedback, but if you have any feedback, you can always email info@reclaimingtherepublic.org, or you can call 425-270-5416 and leave a message. I don't care, 24/7, 365, that phone line is open for you every day, every hour of the day, even on holidays. Now, one of the things that I want to impress upon as we're wrapping up 6 and going into Article 7 is some of the most important things that we have to do are some of the simplest things that we have to do. In other words, we have to do those things that, it doesn't defy logic. It goes, why in the heck aren't we doing that? And I'll give you a good case in point. When we look at understanding the Constitution, I have stated to you before that Article 7 is the most important part of the Constitution. And that's only because I've been looking and looking and working, reading and understanding the framers' perspective for so long. I unequivocally understand how and why Article 7 is so important. And the reason why it's so important is for the most simplest of reasons. When we look at some of the most important parts of Christianity, some of the most important doctrines that we have to incorporate in our lives, one of the most important, and it's simple, it's very simple, it's a simple concept to understand, is prayer, right? Isn't prayer one of the most simplistic things that's a part of the doctrine that we have to engage to actually receive revelations and so forth? And some of these other things that we have to learn about Christianity, that are many of the principles and laws and or covenants are very simple, folks. Article 7 may be simple, but it is that important in understanding. And more people than not, I was going to say most, more people than most understand, the Second Amendment. They understand the religious freedom, and they don't understand the Constitution because they do not understand Article 7. Article 6, for the most part, there are two parts of it. The parts, and the reason why we're still doing Article 6, is the very final clause, the very final sentence of Article 6. We already covered the big juicy part about the Supremacy Clause, and we pointed out that the federal government is only supreme over those things delegated. Their jurisdiction is limited to those delegated powers. We've covered this in so many different ways, but what we wanted to do is we wanted to emphasize, as equally as important as their limitations of their laws that they create, they are equally bound in those same limitations regarding their treaties. Treaties are ultimately debt agreements. It is a contract that they agree to take money from somebody and pay them back so that they can spend money on this, 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 and this. And so when we're dealing with a fraudulent government, And when I say fraudulent, what it is doing is fraudulent. The form of government, our representation, and, you know, I mean, they've perverted lots of different ways, and they've done this so that they can ingratiate themselves. The reason the parties took control of the Electoral College in the 1800s had everything to do with making sure that the president wouldn't be vetoing Congress as Congress started moving towards unrighteous dominion or unrighteous actions to, you know, put us on a course to destroy ourselves. And actually what they did was they aggrandized the executive to be able to do things and create law and to dictate like a tyrant. Lincoln was a tyrant. Teddy Roosevelt was a tyrant. So forth and so on. Technically, since Andrew Jackson, sorry for the frog again, Andrew Jackson was the first of our kings in a long string of kings. So back to the second part. Now, we understood that the Supremacy Clause kind of bound everything they did by law and treaty to the enumerated powers, enumerated roles, responsibilities, and powers. So moving on to the oath of office, we kind of already went through this in detail, that this oath, and as a matter of fact, this is one of the things we pointed out of the ratification base that brought James Monroe to the approving of the Constitution, because he saw this legal binding oath a absolute blessing. Back in the days when somebody could actually say, hey, you just violated your oath, you knew you did, and you had to either defend or correct the problem. People just didn't lie and weren't deceitful, because they were afraid that if it got out, that they, you know, their reputation would be just absolutely destroyed. Honor meant more to a man back in those days than life itself. Today, honor means nothing. And as a matter of fact, the less integrity and the less honor that you possess, the richer you can get and the more powerful you can become. That is the paradigm of today. And so we're absolutely 180 out from what our framers and how they believed and how they looked. And that's all because of our education system. That's all because of even our religion. Our religion started serving mammon back in the 1800s. Our religions, because when we started moving towards professional clergy and that type of stuff, we literally started migrating towards serving mammon. Anyway, so we understand that this oath was very powerful. We pointed to the 14th Amendment that gave us the teeth to absolutely, we the people could absolutely enforce by the supreme law of the land and by demanding that this part, see, we've already heard Congress talk about this. You've heard me talk about this for a much longer period of time. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind, because I've been railing on this for a long, long time, that it is starting to permeate into different venues, but it's permeating in a perverted manner, because Congress wants to apply their own interpretation of rebellion when it is clear it's only rebellion against the Constitution, not the status quo, not the violating, or let me come up with a better word for it, not the fraudulent or the violation forms of government. We're not supposed to support those things. We're supposed to support the Constitution. Same thing with the oath. The oath demands that they support it. So if when you rebel against the Constitution, you have committed moral perjury. And so you are to be removed from office immediately. As I was stating, that there is no trial, there is no impeachment in this process. None. You violate your oath of office, boom, it's done. You're removed from office, and you are banned for life from ever being able to enter into public service ever again. How beautiful is that? Now, think in your mind where we would have been from the 14th Amendment, from the 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, fully ratified. As a matter of fact, I think it might have been ratified in 1867, but Nevertheless, when it was fully ratified and it became the law, and everybody learned this, there would have been laws being created in every state, and those laws would have been at the very top of the heap, and that everybody would have understood this, that we have the power to remove any corrupt politician or any politician refusing to support the Constitution. Wow. What a missing link. That has been the missing link, and it's been there all this time, folks. Just imagine, we would not be dealing with Nixon taking us off the gold standard. We would not be dealing with the SEC or the fact that the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ and all these other different exchanges have forced and created this forced retirement system for corporations instead of actual pensions. And actually, you know, having people becoming diligent. Instead, it is a sham and a game that your 401ks, because it's all government controlled. And it all feeds the beast. So, anyway, let's kind of back out. So we've kind of covered all of this, the oath of office, the supremacy clause. There is one small little caveat, one small little clause that is left, that is absolutely being violated. And that clause is the religious test clause. We will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. All right, so, this little thing called religious tests. This is what it says. But no religious test shall ever, wow, that's pretty strong. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Now, let me ask you something. Is a state governed under the jurisdiction of the United States? Absolutely, it is. When new states come into the Union, they become a union and subject to all laws in pursuant to the Constitution and all treaties under their authority. Therefore, all states are subject to the United States under those very specific delegated cases, right? Okay. So if states are, can states create laws that, you know, can enforce anything that is a violation of the Constitution? Now, when we get into the 14th Amendment, this is what I'm taking this really long trip around this mountain so that you understand where I'm going with this. No state, as a matter of fact, in the 14th Amendment, Section 1, we'll get into this in detail, but no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. However, there's this one line right here that basically says, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Now, does that mean that only the United States, this only applies to federal positions? No. Because of the 14th Amendment, this actually applies to all positions that are created under the public trust. Now, let me ask you this. Are corporations and businesses that are established under a state, can a state create or allow a business to be created that will allow religious tests to be performed? Now, I'm going to presume that if it's religion and it's a religious organization, so here's the problem I have. I have a problem with the fact that states have any say or any control over religions whatsoever. Because, bottom line, religions are separated and not a revenue. I mean, they can't be taxed. And they are to be bastions of freedom, academic freedom, medical freedom, all of these things. They are outside the purview of the United States, technically, right? I mean, because all of these restrictions are held against any type of oppression for religion. And so the fact is that we actually have religion controlled by states and religion actually being controlled by the federal government is, you know, it just hurts my head. It shouldn't be. They shouldn't be in 501s. They shouldn't be incorporated. They should be free entities. The only religion that should not be allowed in the United States are religions and ideologies that are contrary and counterintuitive to individual liberty and individual sovereignty and the principles that are protected and espoused by this Constitution and our government. And so that would mean communism, that would mean Islam, any of these other religions that do not and cannot recognize the Constitution being the supreme law of the land over all those things delegated. In other words, you want to start creating Sharia law, you want to start, you know, legalizing, you know, sin and those types of things, because that's what communism does and that's what Islam does. Islam, Sharia law, and the removing the consequences of sin, that's communism. That type of welfare, enabling of those things. So those ideologies should not exist and should have no place in America. No place whatsoever in America. But people started just accepting these carte blanche, you know, oh, well, all religion. This means all religion. No, it does not. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we kind of go into is that we're not to keep. I mean, the Tory acts, here were Americans that were part of the American colonies. They were citizens of these states, and they were kicked out just because they had loyalty to the crown. That was not acceptable. It's the same thing with any kind of religion or any type of doctrine that would be absolutely unacceptable or antithetical to our constitutional republic. And so what does this have to do with religious tests? So putting religion and these religious organizations aside, and these, let's just call them nonprofit trust organizations, whatever you want to call them, that are out there trying to do these things. Okay, so they are what they are. Maybe those have, you know, a unique flavor to them, to where they're actually trying to do a very specific thing within their own religious sect or what have you. Yeah, so in other words, we're kind of treading on thin ice here. And GR loves treading on thin ice because I believe it's very important to start challenging paradigms. Every paradigm regarding the Constitution must be challenged so that we can understand it better. That's how we understand the Constitution, by challenging it. And so here's the challenge I have. When a party applies, because a party is a nonprofit organization, is it not? Yes, it is, actually. But it is a political affiliation, which means that it is not a religious affiliation or religious organization. Now, are parties and religious organizations the same thing? No. They are separate. They're filed separately, or they're registered separately. Does a state have a right to register religion? I think they do, because I believe that they should, because you got to remember, many of the states banned most of the problematic religions at the very beginning. I mean, Islam was banned until the 1900s in America. Most Jews were banned from being able to open practice or even exist in many of the states until the, you know, late, you know, I wouldn't say late, maybe mid or kind of early mid years of the 1800s. I think Massachusetts didn't allow Jews to openly practice until 1833, something like that. So my point is this. When we look at states and when we look at businesses, can businesses actually vet? If it's just a business and it's not something that is, you know, ideologically, I believe there's a right of association. There's a right to say, okay, you know, we want people that are going to agree with us. And, you know, good case in point is like a BYU or Notre Dame. You know, they employ these professors. Should their professors agree with their positions and standing? Absolutely, they should. And they should be able to have these types of religious tests. Because, again, that institution was designed to benefit those of their faith. And so, but parties are not. And so here is the question I have. Please explain to me how parties can start injecting religious tests. See, they do. Because when you start looking at the Democrats, they are you Christian? Are you Catholic? Are you, you know, what is your faith? And as a matter of fact, they do this in government as well. The party and the players of the party, Feinstein is notorious for using religious tests in trying to excoriate people for their beliefs. The people that are going to be taking a seat at the Supreme Court or what have you. Clearly, she is violating the Constitution by applying a religious test. We're kind of concerned because your faith is against abortion and you might rule against that. She right there is applying a religious test. The same thing happens at the party level. And if you have a party that is, you know, pro, you have to be pro-abortion, you have to, or, you know, you have to be pro-free life, then I have a problem with that because it starts injecting religion into the party apparatus or into a business. When it's, I mean, it's one thing if you say, okay, we're going to be, and let's just say the Catholics want to have their own party. It's the Catholic Party. Folks, parties are factions. They're already hostile and they're already, I'll just say, pests. They're parasites that are actually destructive in our form of government. George Washington went into the details of this. And the best way we can go forward in healing America is by obsoleting and destroying the party apparatuses. And one of the things that the parties fundamentally do is they start applying religious tests. And they start throwing in their religious dogma into their... And you know what? I believe in religious dogma in my home. And we have a right to go to a church that gives us the religious dogma that we seek. Seeking the truth, if they want to call it dogma or what have you. But does that play under this Constitution in parties? Well, based on this Constitution, no. And the question is, can they actually do this at the state level? Can you create a state party, or can you create a state business that, you know, is supposedly a business that has nothing to do with religion and ideology, but all of a sudden they start mandating the religions and so forth. Will you do this? Will you do? They shouldn't. And as a matter of fact, this goes to the 14th Amendment. No state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities guaranteed to a U.S. citizen. We'll be right back. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so trying to stay out of the gray area, what I want to do is I want to help you understand the whole point. Look right above this line, that the requirement is to support the Constitution. And no religious test shall ever be required for anybody seeking public trust or office of the United States or under the United States. You know, anyway, I'm paraphrasing. But the point is that these religious tests in parties, these religious tests in organizations, have no place in our lives. Why? It's pretty simple. If we are focused on compliance to the Constitution, then we don't need to actually have a religious test like, what is your religious views on abortion? Instead, let's put it into this context. Is abortion an enumerated power for the federal government? No. Then the federal government has no enumerated power to be able to take the life of a baby or to support that concept of abortion at all. They can't tax, they can't be involved in abortion because it is not an enumerated power. So here's the other question. Has your state amended their constitution, granting them the overseers and the authority to be able to allow women to actually kill their babies? If it's not in the state constitution, just because it may not be delegated to the federal government means it belongs to the states, doesn't mean that the states actually possess it. We, the people, because if you read the 10th Amendment, it is respectively reserved to the people or to the states. And so the states, if they have in their constitution the requirement to the preservation of life, and then they have an amendment allowing abortion, they actually have a conflict in their own constitution. Unless they actually change that preservation of life and amend that concept of what life is. And 9 times out of 10, they didn't do that. 9 times out of 10, they never go through and clean up these unconstitutional amendments that they throw in. They just, you know, they just pile it on and say, well, this becomes a supreme law. No. If it doesn't address the other laws that have been delegated, that law is a conflict with the existing laws. The whole point of amending and changing something that's already been granted is you actually have to address why and how that's been changed. If, and in this very specific case, if the state has the authority and responsibility of protecting life, and then they say, you know, abortion is legal and they're going to tax and whatever they're going to do, then that becomes a direct conflict. And you have to go into the nuances of each of these, because you're going to find that majority of the times when people write amendments, they don't understand the real problem and they don't make the changes to those conflicts that are within the Constitution already, within your state constitution. I know that because when I look at the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment did not address the uniformity clause in Article 1, Section 8, nor did it address, the 16th Amendment didn't address the uniformity clause, and the 17th Amendment did not address the Article 1, the Senate representing the state legislature. Doesn't matter whether they don't vote for them or not, they're still accountable to the state legislature. And then secondly, that the state legislatures do not lose their suffrage if they didn't give up their consent. So when we start looking at it, the way we just applied it, like, well, that's the law now. Well, hold on here. There is still relevant law that amendment did not address. So when we create these types of conflicts, they need to be resolved. And I'm going to tell you that you don't leave it to the Supreme Court to resolve. You have to take it to the states, and the states need to kind of coalesce into a tribunal, and they have to actually determine with a clear supermajority. They need 38 states to actually say, yes, this is that. And maybe you want to call that a convention, but that's not a convention to amend the Constitution. That would be a convention to define the Constitution and provide that definition to the federal government to say, look, this is how we've interpreted it. But you need 38 states to be able to do that. Technically, you only need a majority. Technically, when it comes down to violations and so forth, you only need a majority to enforce the Constitution. If it's about enforcement, if it's about clarifications and so forth, you only need that majority. But if it's to change something, then you do actually require enough states to actually get Congress to provide the appropriate amendment to make the change, either to get rid of that amendment, to rescind that amendment, or to modify it so that it actually no longer has conflicts. Period. You can't just ignore it and say, well, it's kind of messy, but we're going to accept it the way it is. No, you can't do that. Not under the rules or not under this defined constitution. It has to be tight. It has to be squeaky clean. Period. So anyway, so that kind of wraps this whole part of Article 6 up. Now let's get into, because I could actually go on more and more and more about this religious test, because obviously it's one of those hot button issues. But what we want to do is we actually want to cover Article 7. This is the article the GR tells you is the most sacred article of the Constitution. Again, look at what the Articles of Confederation had. Look at how they were organized. They were kind of messy. and very few people could remember what's in all of the articles. And in most cases, it did not, because it did not define and separate the magistrate. Because bottom line, they didn't have an executive. Congress was both the Supreme Court and the executive, as well as the legislative. Continental Congress had supposedly all the general powers. It was kind of like Parliament, and it was a unicameral Parliament. So in other words, it was a representative of the people and only the people. So it was problematic because it would be able to actually be tossed to and fro based on the whims of the majority of the people. There were all sorts of problems that we could see had the Articles of Confederation maintained itself. We would have been destroyed in so many different ways and so many different times and situations. So looking at Article 7, yes, it is the ratification process. But why is it so important? Because it simplifies and clarifies this Constitution. This is the only part of the Constitution that provides this clarity. And I say that because you can look at the Supremacy Clause, but most people kind of get that wrong. But when you read the Constitution, and if you have any form of legal understanding, it becomes perfectly clear. Because if you understand contract law, the fundamentals of contract law, the shaking of a hand, coming to an agreement and shaking the hand, and then exercising that contract. This is Article 7. The ratification of the conventions of 9 states. What does that mean? What does ratification mean? The legal definition of ratification is the same back then as it is today. It is the formal process of accepting a compact, contract, or treaty. And in this particular case, it's a compact. Why is it a compact and not a contract? Well, it's basically the same thing, isn't it? Well, there's only one nuance that's different. With a compact, you have multiple parties to the compact. A contract is usually between one or two people. A charter is basically like an edict from one individual, like Johann Adam Weizenhaupt, who created the charter for the Illuminati. He's the one that created it. And was he in a position to do so? Apparently he was. More importantly, every single one of the states were created by the monarchy via a charter. They didn't create constitutions. They didn't create compacts. They didn't come into an agreement. Well, if you do this, I'll do that. No. This was all under the full control and discretion of the king. This is why this whole concept of free and sovereign states was such a revolutionary principle. This revolutionary concept that all of the states in this union were to be free and sovereign. And that they were designed and developed and created by the sub-element of government within them. That the counties were the ones that created the states. Now, it may have been maybe perfunctory. It may have been something that was just really simplified. And, people just marginalized it. But the counties played the key role. The counties were the parents, and the people of those counties were the parents of the state. Now, if this was all just people, then things would get really muddy and things would be really problematic, because when people die, well, what happens to the stakeholder? What happens to that shareholder, when they die? What goes into an estate? And then it gets split up and it gets perverted. In this compact and in the way we have our government, because these entities, the county, the state, and the United States, they're all perpetual entities, then everything applies and it continues on. It doesn't devolve, it can change, And there are modes for that with Article 5 or what? The amendment process, but we'll be right back after these two promos. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so last segment. So as I was just telling you, that the ratification, the word itself means a formal process. It is a legal process that is done in the accepting of a compact. Now, if you look at how the states handled the ratifications, did they just go out and create a general election? No. As a matter of fact, what they say here is the ratification of the conventions of nine states. So basically, this Constitution required that the states call a convention to ratify this Constitution. In other words, they wanted, you know, for this Constitution not to be accepted, it had to be debated. It couldn't be just shut down. So any state that actually wanted to slam dunk this into ratifying it really didn't need to debate it at all. They kind of just do-si-do'd right into the convention. Delaware was the first, right? They were the first that just kind of danced right on in there, and they said, okay, we're ratifying it. And they didn't even debate it. Why? Because they saw this as great, because they saw it as being protected. They were protected from the big and the powerful states, that they would maintain their sovereignty, and that those states, nor could this federal government, wage any warfare against them. I mean, it was a slam dunk for them. I give Delaware a lot of heat. I give them a lot of grief, whatever you call people from Delaware, Delawareans or whatever. Anyway, Delawareites, I digress. So I give them a lot of, you know, contention just because they didn't debate this Constitution. But they deserve the credit because they do prove that as the smallest, one of the smallest states in the Union, they recognize the protections that they possessed under this Constitution, that they would be able to thrive without having to worry about being consumed or usurped and sucked up and annexed by a bigger state. It could never happen. And it never did happen. Show me one state that has sucked up other states in America, like we have seen in Europe, like we've seen, you know, throughout the world. And we have seen states kind of breaking up, and that's okay, especially if there's different reasons for it. Absolutely, it's okay to split states. But for states to start coming in and consuming them because they want to expand their tax base, oh, well, here's this little state called Delaware. Maryland could have easily done that, or Virginia could have easily done that. You know, that's why it's the Delmarva Peninsula, right? Anyway, the point is this, that when you look at some of these smaller states, Georgia was another state that slam dunked it. They looked at it and they said, this benefits us. It protects our slave trade. It maintains our sovereignty. We need to be a part of this. I mean, there were all sorts of reasons why Georgia didn't debate the Constitution. They happened to be the southern edge of the United States. And just south of them was the nation of Spain that was, you know, trying to grow and permeate itself into North America. And Georgia was the buffer zone. It was kind of like, you know, our defense against Spain. And as they started expanding, going across into Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and so forth, and they were already present in Louisiana, we were trying to fill the gap between them. And so we started doing that. And we aggressively did that with, you know, kind of like the early stages of Manifest Destiny. Fact of the matter, folks, is that some of these small states actually testified in the way they acted that they recognized their sovereignty was to be protected and that they had no, they just really didn't have any cares or concerns because they saw this Constitution as one that would preserve their sovereignty. Look today at what is going on. Now, not that not debating wasn't good. I think it's good to see both sides of this. Having the vigorous debates are very critical. And the fact that we have, what, 6-7 states that debated and gave us a heated exchange that actually, and consistently across every single one of these states, there was no disparity between how they defined each of these clauses as they went through the Constitution. This is so important to understand that the ratification debates are very succinct and very clear on how they defined each of the clauses, whether that be the defense and general welfare, whether that be the commerce, whether that be the supremacy or the necessary and proper clauses. Folks, friends, I want you to understand that when we look at the ratification debates, they are the scriptures to this Constitution. And the fact that this had to happen, because, and I think the good Lord knew that if by going into convention, this Constitution was going to be ratified because it was recognized as a superior governing document. It's still today recognized as the most superior governing document ever to exist on the face of the earth in all the histories, all the annals of histories of mankind that and civilizations that we're aware of, period, without a doubt. So when they got to 9 states, so what does that mean, by the way? So let me back out again, one little clarity on ratification. Who ratifies? Who is it that ratifies a contract or a compact? It is the sovereign. It is the party. There are a party to the compact. In other words, when you have two people, the parties is, you know, person one and person two, right? Person A, person B, whatever. However you want to break it down. When we look at who was it that was ratifying this Constitution, was it the 60-some million, or not 60, the 6-some million folks or 10 million folks that were alive, or 9 million, whatever was alive at the time of the Constitution, were they the ones that ratified it? No. It was the 13 states. So it tells you who the parties are as well. That one short line of what, 7 words? The ratification of the conventions of 9 states. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 words. Those eight words clarify, one, what the Constitution is and who the parties are to it. How much more simple do we need to make this? So backing up to what I said maybe Monday, I forget when I said it, but I know I talked about the 6th and the 7th. If you look at the Constitution from Articles 1 to 6, the Lord, in his divine wisdom in inspiring these men at that Constitution Convention, he took the 13 Articles of Confederation and took and expanded beautifully and separated powers and separated, you know, responsibilities in such a way to create so many checks and balances within this government. And he did it in six articles and rested the power in the seventh upon the states, a separate entities, separate entities altogether, as in creating another check and balance over this Constitution and over the federal government. How beautiful is that? I mean, that's like creating the world in 6 days and resting. In other words, the Constitution, in delegating or defining that the states are the parties and are the sovereigns over this Constitution, is resting the power upon the states, like sanctifying the Constitution and giving the authority over it to the sovereign and separate independent states. I just can't emphasize how beautiful and how important this principle and concept is. Because in so doing, we can see clearly who has the authority and who has the power to force the federal government into compliance. This is what Madison and Jefferson, this is why we're going to go through right after the Constitution. We will be going into a few of the issues. We'll try to, you know, go through from the Constitution into the resolutions. And there's a couple of things we're going to cover real quick. We'll cover some enabling acts, and we'll cover the Assumption Act is one, the Whiskey Rebellion is another, and then we'll cover and maybe not in that order, but we're going to be covering this stuff so that you can clearly see that when Madison and Jefferson recognized that the federal government was exceeding its authority by passing an act that was not in pursuant to the Constitution, what did they do? Did they just roll over and let it happen? No, they taught the world how this Constitution and how the states were to operate when the federal government got out of line. At any point in time, as long as the states exist and as long as that Constitution exists and the states have not surrendered their Constitution, they can stand up, and as brutal as it may be in peeling back all of the tyranny, it will be still easily done and efficiently and quickly done, because the states still have that authority today. This is why Republic Review is that important. This is why, clearly, Republic Review was the Lord's design in motivating Madison and Jefferson in doing exactly what they did in laying the trail of breadcrumbs out so that we could actually acknowledge what they did and what he inspired them to do. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.